hours, 44 minutes mission elapsed time. The phases of the moon and Earth are complementary. When the moon is new, a full Earth shines in the lunar night. As we see our satellite wax through crescent and first quarter to full, our own world wanes in the moon's sky until it is lost in blackness. On Wednesday, December 13th, Jean Cernan pulled back the shade on Challenger's rendezvous window and saw a blue and white crescent gleaming above the South Massive. He could barely make out a cloud system over the southeastern United States. In mission control, Capcom Gordon Fullerton confirmed that, yes, that's what the satellite picture showed. How amazing, Cernan thought, to be standing on the moon, giving his home planet a weather report. After a quick breakfast, he and Schmidt, by this time a little weary, got ready for Apollo's final moonwalk. They were an hour late getting started, but there wasn't any particular need to rush. At the very first mission review meeting, Jack Schmidt had lobbied for a fourth moonwalk. He'd worked on the initial design studies for the J missions, and he knew that four excursions had been part of those original plans, and now he had no qualms about telling the engineers what their hardware was capable of. On paper, he was right. You could squeeze in a fourth moonwalk, but it left you with very tight reserves of water and battery power in case of an emergency, like a blown water tank. The chutes and backpacks hadn't been tested for the extra trip outside, though everyone suspected they would hold up. The planners spent the better part of a day with Schmidt trying to talk him out of the idea, but to no avail. He knew he was right. Cernan just hung back and let Schmidt say his piece. Finally, Apollo spacecraft program manager Owen Morris asked Cernan for his own recommendation. "I think we can do it," Cernan said, "but I'll respect your judgment." Schmidt shot Cernan a dirty glance. That was the end of it. And if Schmidt felt some lingering frustration at using Apollo to what he saw as less than its full capability, he no longer feared having to leave the moon without enough information. This day they would have a good 7 hours on the surface, enough time to sample the North Massive and the sculptured hills and a couple of craters on the valley floor, and then no more. So there they were, in their hard suits, moving like tin soldiers as they prepared to open the hatch. When Cernan emerged from the tiny cabin at around 4:30 p.m., he saw a small sign taped to the landing leg. He did not know who had put it there, but it must have been one of the checkout crew at the Cape. On each moonwalk, he'd pause to read it aloud as a kind of public prayer. Now he read it again. Godspeed the crew of Apollo 17. 5:37 p.m. The rover headed north across a sun-drenched moonscape, past the giant crater Henry, and when it reached Turning Point Rock, the men headed east toward their destination, a big dark boulder perched on the side of the North Massive. They had all known the boulder would be there. It was visible on the Apollo 15 photographs, where it was a tiny dot trailed by a 1,500-foot-long furrow that recorded its plunge down the mountainside. As they got closer, Cernan and Schmidt could see that it was actually five separate boulders it had broken apart before coming to rest near the bottom of the massive. As always, the rover gave them no hint of the severe slope. Cernan, on the uphill side, could barely raise his suited body out of his seat. Schmidt, meanwhile, thought for a moment that he might tumble down the hill. While Cernan struggled through his chores at the rover, Schmidt climbed a few yards upslope and raised his outer visor, which was now badly scratched by dust, to peer at the wall of stone. It was just like the tan-gray rocks he'd seen yesterday at the South Massive, except that it had giant vesicles, holes where gas bubbles had once been, which meant that it had once been molten. But the holes weren't round, as you would see in a lava flow that cooled in place, but flattened ellipses, meaning that somehow the rock had flowed before it had had a chance to solidify. Sometime later, a great pressure had acted on the rock, for Schmidt could see fractures branching through it. It was difficult for him to tell much more. On Earth, geologists must peer at their work through a variety of obscuring materials, such as moss or lichen, or, in the desert, a smooth varnish of oxides created by the action of wind and rain. On the moon, rocks develop a brownish patina of impact glass from millions of years of micrometeorite rain. to get a good look at this rock, Schmidt knew Cernan would have to put the hammer to it. In the back room, Bill Mulberger's team watched as Schmidt methodically examined the boulder. Every so often he would change his mind about what he saw, verbalizing the thought process that goes on in the mind of every geologist in the field. They knew that Schmidt had attacked complex problems like this one in Norway and in Sudbury, Ontario, where the remains of a giant impact crater are preserved. Years later, Schmidt would say that his edge on the moon was that he was able to react to the millions of bits of visual data and sort out the most significant few and do it within seconds. The mind, he would say, is not in a spacesuit. Now the television camera caught him taking pictures, standing in one of the big hollows of the boulder track. With his golden outer visor raised, his face was clearly visible within the clear inner helmet, framed by his communications hat and darkened by a week-old beard. As he spoke to Cernan, something about a piece of gear, his mouth could be seen forming the words. Suddenly he was no longer a faceless, mirror-helmeted astronaut, but Harrison H. Schmidt, a geologist at the ultimate field site. He noticed the camera pointed at him, looked straight at it, and mugged a smile. Then, having spotted something new to investigate, he turned to his left and headed out of view. Working together now, Cernan and Schmidt attacked the boulder, Cernan wielding the hammer. It was ironic. Schmidt had helped design that hammer, but he couldn't hold it. The handle was too big for him to grip. The men had agreed in training that Cernan, with his massive hands, would be the mission's hammer-bearer. The only thing Schmidt had to do was teach Cernan to hit the edge of a rock, which was much easier to chip, instead of pounding away brute force style at the middle. Schmidt made his way out of the shadow and around to the boulder's sunlit face, using his scoop like a walking stick. The more he looked, the more details he noticed. Within the tan-gray boulder were huge pieces of blue-gray, caught up like pebbles in the tar of a new road. They looked just like the blue-gray rocks they'd picked up at the South Massive, and within the blue-gray there were smaller white chunks that looked like anorthosite, perhaps pieces of primordial crust. Cernan thought the entire boulder was one enormous breccia, but Schmidt wasn't so sure. The tan-gray rock had definitely been molten, and Schmidt thought it had formed when a pocket of magma caught up pieces of the blue-gray breccia within it. Whatever it was, this boulder had a story to tell, and if they were going to decipher it, they would need as much time as they could get. Parker informed them that they could have the lavish allotment of 1 hour and 20 minutes, but Schmidt was reluctant to take it all. It meant giving up another stop on the massive later. After 36 minutes confronting the boulder, Schmidt told Parker, "I've done the best I can." But that would prove to be more than good enough. In the months and years to come, analyses of the split boulder would testify to the violence of the impacts that formed the lunar basins. It turned out Cernan and Schmidt had both been right, in a sense. The boulder was one big breccia, but the tan-gray part had indeed been molten. It had melted because it had been subjected to forces almost beyond human comprehension. The split boulder was a kind of tableau, a geologic freeze frame of the events that immediately followed the impact of the Serenitatis asteroid 3.8 billion years ago. Hurtling into the moon at perhaps 10 miles per second, the rocky intruder exploded with the power of billions of H-bombs. For perhaps 100 miles around, huge volumes of the crust were pulverized or melted and flung outward in a spray of debris. Even as ejecta flew through space, shock waves contorted the lunar crust, pushing up rings of mountains like ripples on the surface of a pond. One of the rings became the Taurus Mountains. A vast sheet of molten rock sprayed out from the blast point, blanketing the newly formed mountains, sweeping up pre-existing boulders in its broiling flow. Some of the boulders were themselves breccias that had recorded earlier cataclysms. Now more debris fleeing the growing basin piled on top of the newly formed Taurus Mountains. Within minutes it was all over. The face of the moon was scarred by a crater 450 miles across. Over time, the melt sheet cooled and solidified into a layer that was visible high on the massifs. 100 million years later, mare lavas migrated upward through the fractured crust and erupted at the surface. In the Taurus-Littrow Valley, the last of these volcanic outpourings were accompanied by the fire fountains that created the dark mantle and the orange soil. Much, much later, only 800,000 years ago, a house-sized chunk from the North Massif was dislodged and tumbled down the mountainside to where two explorers now worked. 6:27 p.m. The back room wanted a rake sample, so Schmidt headed back to the rover. If they were going to have time for another stop on the mountain, he'd better work fast. Meanwhile, Cernan struggled up the hill so that he could shoot a documentary panorama that would include the boulder. At one point, Schmidt happened to walk into the field of view, and the pictures, which would show him dwarfed by the dark mass of stone, would become some of the most famous of the Apollo program. Cernan would see them reproduced in countless books and magazine articles. Looking at them, he would also see a patch of soil on top of a low rocky ledge that would forever bear the imprint of his hands, where he had collected samples. He would wish that he had taken a moment to write his daughter Tracy's name in the dust. From this height, for the first time, he could see all of Taurus-Littrow. Up here, he could spot all the places he and Schmidt had visited on the South Massif and the valley floor. To his left, beyond the flank of the North Massif, were the sculptured hills, where he and Schmidt would soon be headed, and way out on the plains, a tiny dot of aluminum and mylar. It occurred to Cernan that he had spent his adult life working farther and farther out on a limb, from flying jets to flying in Earth orbit, then leaving his home world to come within 9 miles of another one, and finally returning to descend from the sky into this valley. Getting outside, and yesterday driving miles into the distance and over a hill so that he could not even see his lunar module. During the sleep periods, lying in that tin can that popped and creaked in the full-strength lunar sun, Cernan's thoughts were not about undoing the steps in that chain, getting off the moon, out of lunar orbit, and safely through the Earth's atmosphere, but of what he was missing. What he could be doing instead of wasting precious hours by sleeping. As much as Schmidt, he understood how little 3 days was when you had a place like Taurus-Littrow to explore, and yet they'd accomplished more than he ever expected. With the excited voice of a kid who's just climbed his first mountain, Cernan said, "You know, Jack, when we finish, we will have covered this whole valley from corner to corner." Schmidt deadpanned. "That was the idea." In the back room, Bill Mulberger said, "It's only 6:30. We've got a long night." A surprised Dale Jackson said, "Is that what time of day it is? I'm all screwed up. I don't even know what day of the week it is." And no wonder. Everyone in the back room had been going full bore for 3 days. Even now, with a bonanza from the split boulder in hand, they worried that Cernan and Schmidt were cutting uncomfortably into the time reserved for the next stop. They told Jim Lovell to ask that Parker hurry them along. Lovell did so, then informed Mulberger's team that a few extra minutes late in the moonwalk would have to be reserved for some chores at the Alsep. He wanted to know which geology stop to take it out of. Jackson replied, "Take it out of Apollo 18. 7:49 p.m. When historians review the scores of hours of Apollo videotapes, they will no doubt take note of Gene Cernan and Jack Schmidt's visit to the sculptured hills and what they did there, not with their hammer and scoop, but with themselves. To be sure, the geologic rewards were great. Schmidt discovered a small boulder which, along with some of the samples from Nansen, would reveal that the ancient crust of the moon was chemically more heterogeneous than theorists had suspected. But the exploration was just as revealing of the explorers themselves, because after 3 days of intense effort, they let themselves have a little fun. Having climbed high upslope to the boulder, Schmidt took an excuse to perform the geologist's time-honored ritual. He called out to Cernan, "Are you ready for this?" With one boot, Schmidt shoved the rock into a lazy tumble that abruptly died. He chased after it, giving it a kick that sent dust flying, but did little to move the rock. "Go! Roll!" he yelled. "Look, I would roll on this slope. Why don't you?" And when he and Cernan had finished breaking off a sample, Schmidt gave a ballet-style leap and bounded downhill toward the rover. Then, forsaking any trace of adulthood, he began hopping on 2 feet with arms outstretched, pretending to ski. He swung his body from side to side, sample bags flopping against his backpack. He made shushing noises. "I can't keep my edges. A little hard to get a good hip rotation." A minute later, Cernan came kangaroo-hopping down the hill after him. "Whee!" as if to affirm that the strongest emotion of being on the moon was simply elation. 10:36 p.m. The replacement fender finally gave out during the drive back to the LM. Cernan said, "There's got to be a point where the dust just overtakes you and everything mechanical quits moving. Lunar dust is abrasive. Very abrasive because of all the little rock fragments knocked off by micrometeorites. Cernan had only to look at the handle of the geology hammer. The rubber coating was worn through to bare metal. He and Schmidt had been religious about greasing the suit zippers and cleaning the wrist rings to keep the suits in good working order, and by God, they were holding up, despite the abuse heaped on them. Schmidt would never lose his amazement at that. Just like almost everything else on Apollo, those suits worked better than anybody ever expected them to. It went back to the motivation of the people who built them, tested them, and flew them. It showed what can happen when people believe that the thing they are working on is the most important thing they will do in their lives, and they don't want to be responsible for screwing it up. No doubt those suits could have gone further, and no doubt so could Cernan and Schmidt, but not this day. The past 6 hours on the surface had been the most physically demanding of all their excursions. Unlike yesterday, when they'd spent as much as an hour riding the rover between stops, today was fast-paced, with much of the work on steep slopes. At the last geology stop, on the valley floor, Cernan and Schmidt had hit a wall. They worked not for the thrill of discovery, but simply to get their work done. But at the last minute, with mission control hurrying them back to the rover, Schmidt had discovered a layer of unusually bright white soil. "Come here, Jean," he said. "We can't leave this." They made the decision, on their own, to stay longer, and mission control let them. For a time, the discovery seemed to revive them, but when the geologists tried to argue for an extension, Flight Director Jerry Griffin said no. He'd heard Cernan and Schmidt complain about tired hands and wouldn't take the risk of having them end up too worn out to handle an emergency, and that was the end of it. Griffin had been right. Back at Challenger, amid the litter of 3 days of activity, Schmidt had helped pack up the rock boxes, and it was all he could do to get his hands to work. When he discovered an unused core tube, he drove it into the ground by hand, holding onto the lander for support. Then he tossed this last lunar sample in with the others. Now, all that remained was for Cernan to drive the rover to its final resting place, where it would televise the next day's liftoff. First, however, he and Cernan would attend to a few moments of ceremony. NASA was hosting young students from 70 different countries. They were watching the moonwalk from Houston. Before the flight, Cernan had the idea to distribute pieces of rock from Torres Litro to museums around the world, and NASA planned to tie it in with the visit of these children. And so he and Cernan stood before the TV camera while Cernan, holding a rock, explained. "It's a rock composed of many fragments, of many sizes and many shapes, probably from all parts of the moon, perhaps billions of years old, that have grown together to become a cohesive rock, outlasting the nature of space, sort of living together in a very coherent, very peaceful manner." Cernan would look back, wishing he'd had more time to prepare his remarks. "We hope this will be a symbol of what our feelings are, and a symbol of mankind, that we can live in peace and harmony in the future. And now, let me bring this camera around." Cernan grabbed the TV camera and pointed it at Challenger's front landing gear, where a plaque commemorated the final lunar landing. Schmidt's contribution to that plaque had been to add, below the customary pictures of Earth, a small picture of the moon, showing the places where men had landed. But Schmidt had not been successful in another hard-fought effort to change its wording. He had wanted something to reflect what he still firmly believed, that even if no one came back to the moon for 20 years, let those explorers include Joe Allen's little boy and other children of his generation, the return was inevitable. Instead, the message spoke of finality. Now Cernan removed the cover and read the message. "Here man completed his first explorations of the moon, December 1972 A.D. May the spirit of peace in which we came be reflected in the lives of all mankind. Schmidt listened to his commander's words. Within his suit, he heard the reassuring whir of cooling pumps in his backpack, a sound he had almost come to take for granted. Now Cernan was saying, "This is our commemoration that we'll be here until someone like us, until some of you who are out there, who are the promise of the future, come back to read it again and to further the exploration and meaning of Apollo." Schmidt's fingers were raw within his gloves. His arms ached with the exertions of a full working day on the surface. And as he listened, he realized, it's over. 11:34 p.m. After loading the rock boxes and other cargo into the LM, he had to climb up the ladder several times to pass the massive stowage bags to Schmidt. Jean Cernan stood alone on the moon, his spacesuit covered with grime. He was somewhat out of breath. Now he spoke, trying to cut through the fatigue, to imbue his words with energy to speak for the history books. "Bob, this is Jean. As I take man's last steps from the surface, back home for some time to come, but we believe not too long into the future." His words were interrupted by the sound of his own breathing. "I believe history will record that America's challenge of today has forged man's destiny of tomorrow." As he spoke, Cernan took a last look at the bright and barren wilderness all around him. "And as we leave the moon at Taurus Littro, we leave as we came, and, God willing, as we shall return, with peace and hope for all mankind." He glanced at the earth, high in the southwestern sky, an unmoving, silent witness to a voyager about to begin a long journey back. Once more he spoke. "Godspeed the crew of Apollo 17. Friday, December 15th. Late evening, Houston time. Aboard America, in lunar orbit." Jean Cernan would never have believed that he could feel so comfortable with his neck so far out. It had been more than a day since Challenger had blasted off from Taurus Littro, carrying him and Schmidt into orbit and then, like riding on rails, back to a very happy Ron Evans. In the last phase of the rendezvous, Cernan flew his craft in tight formation with the command module as Challenger danced like a fighter plane under his control. It was his moment of exultation at a mission accomplished. It was his victory roll. With 60% of his maneuvering fuel still untouched, Cernan would have loved to fly beautiful orbital mechanics circles around Evans, but he did not. There could be no distractions. Minutes later, he held the ascent stage still while Evans approached, ever closer, until the cabin filled with the welcome ripple bang of 12 docking latches snapping shut, and Cernan felt that he had come home. Inside America, he couldn't believe how good it felt just to get out of his filthy pressure suit, strip off his long johns, and to wet a washcloth and wash the sweat and the dust off his body. Nothing would get his fingernails clean. The dust had penetrated deep into the quick. It would be weeks before it grew out. No matter, Cernan felt like a new man, even though he and his crew were spending 2 more days in lunar orbit. During training, Cernan hadn't been in favor of these extra days in orbit, but Evans and Schmidt had been so enthusiastic about making more observations that he'd backed off. And now that he was here, he marveled at his own ease. He could settle in and soak up the view. When it came time to leave, then he would worry about the leaving. Cernan was proud of Apollo 17. With 75 hours on the moon, 22 of them outside, and nearly 19 miles total distance covered, this mission had made its mark on the record books. Not a single major problem with the spacecraft, arguably the smoothest and most successful flight of the series, and he had accomplished the goal that he had set for himself almost a decade ago. He could say to himself what only 5 other men could say. He had steered a spaceship to a landing on the moon. That evening, when America was on its 66th circuit of the moon, Jack Schmidt saw his first Earthrise. Looking at that bright crescent, Schmidt sensed the same fragility his predecessors had seen. It had nothing to do with the Earth's appearance, he would say later. it stemmed from its monumental isolation in the blackness. The Earthrise blackened Schmidt's dark mood for a moment. Down on the surface, just before liftoff, he'd felt the first stirrings of sadness at the end of Apollo. Though he felt proud of his accomplishments on the flight, he had never seen his getting to the moon as a personal triumph. He had always felt that he and Cernan were just lucky enough to implement the triumph of others. Apollo 17 represented the last acts of lunar exploration that would be done by members of their generation. But the worst moment came later, just after the docking. The vibrations hadn't even died down when Gordon Fullerton called up and said, "I'd like to take a minute of your time here to read the following statement by the President of the United States of America." Schmidt was annoyed. They had work to do. But Fullerton went ahead and read the message. "As the Challenger leaves the surface of the moon, we are conscious not of what we leave behind, but of what lies before us." Even in Fullerton's quiet, even tone, there was Nixon's cadence. "The dreams that draw humanity forward seem always to be redeemed, if we believe in them strongly enough, and pursue them with diligence and courage." Ironic words, thought Schmidt, considering the fact that Apollo had been conceived under Kennedy and was ending under Nixon. Then Fullerton read the sentence that sank Schmidt's spirits. "This may be the last time in this century that men will walk on the moon, but space exploration will continue." Schmidt barely heard what followed. He couldn't believe his ears. The last time in this century? He hated the words, hated them for their lack of vision. These words from the leader of the nation. Even if Nixon really believed them, he didn't have to say so in a public statement, taking away the hopes of a generation of young people. Schmidt was furious that in the moment of triumph, he had been jolted out of the work of the mission to listen to a statement like that. He would fume silently about it for the rest of the flight. Saturday, December 16th, 5:54 p.m. Houston time, 9 days, 21 hours, 1 minute mission elapsed time. When the SPS engine shut down and a perfect trans-Earth injection burn was behind them, Cernan's crew broke out the television camera. When America regained contact with Earth, they broadcast a view of a huge and nearly full moon. Part of the far side was still visible, including Tsiolkovsky. One of the reasons Schmidt had pushed for a landing there, back in 1970, was that he had hoped it might reignite enough public interest to prompt NASA to reinstate Apollo 18 and 19. As he panned the TV camera across the face of the moon, he captured not only places he had hoped astronauts would go, the lunar poles and Tycho, but some of the places where they had been, Tranquility Base and Hadley, the Descartes Highlands, and a valley at the edge of the Sea of Serenity that would forever be known as Taurus Littro. It was television that set Apollo apart as an exploratory venture. Schmidt could still remember the December night 4 years ago when he and engineer Jack Sevier had stayed up trying to figure out how Frank Borman's crew might televise a picture of the Earth. They ended up telling them to use every filter in the photography kit together, taping them in front of the lens. The fix was a little inelegant, but it worked. That day, humanity saw its home on live TV for the first time. 8 months later, on a hot July night, the pictures were transmitted from a patch of dusty plains on the Sea of Tranquility. Something extraordinary happened when those fuzzy black and white images appeared on television screens around the world. For the first time in the history of exploration, the human species, the developed world, and the developing nations participated in the moment along with the explorers themselves. Now Schmidt was returning to that Earth, having seen it from a great distance. The data held in his mind would be shared with his Earthbound colleagues in a trailer at the Space Center in the days before the Christmas holiday. Then, for a time, he would enter into the debriefing of the self, and his thoughts would return to the sight of that small and lovely crescent beyond the alien shore. The ability to witness an Earthrise, he would note, could happen only if humankind took the well-planned but still significant risk of sending three of its members into an environment utterly foreign to the one in which they had evolved. That is, lunar orbit, with no guarantee of getting those people back. That commitment, Schmidt would come to believe, marked a turning point in human evolution. Human beings had become a space-faring species. What they would do with that new status was still locked in the unknowable future, but Schmidt firmly believed that space exploration would dominate the future of humanity. And what of that humanity, living into another day, unmindful of the leap it had made from the turning Earth? In particular, what events were drawing attention in a country called the United States? In the headlines, Henry Kissinger had reported that serious problems had brought peace talks between the United States and North Vietnam to a halt. The United Mine Workers had elected a new president who pledged to clean up the union. A blizzard had dumped 28 inches of snow on northeastern Ohio, blocking highways and closing airports, with another foot expected before the storm moved east. In a Kansas City hospital, the man who had overseen the final step in the transformation of a nation of revolutionaries, then pioneers, and then immigrants into a superpower, was battling lung congestion, heart problems, and kidney malfunction. Harry Truman was dying, and in a spaceship called America, three men were coming home from the moon. Sunday, December 17th, 2:37 p.m. Houston time, Mission Operations Control Room, Manned Spacecraft Center. Stu Roosa sat next to the Capcom, looking at the big screen at the front of Mission Control. The image was stark, and for the uninitiated, like some of the visitors up in the viewing gallery, it must have looked very strange. It was mostly dark, except for a big white object that looked something like a snowman, or perhaps a mummy lying on its stomach. But Roosa knew exactly what he was seeing. The figure was Ron Evans. He was floating in the void 180,000 miles from Earth, beginning his spacewalk to retrieve the photographic film from the side of the service module. Roosa listened to the transmissions from Apollo 17. He heard a whooshing sound. That was oxygen flowing into Evans's suit from the umbilical. And he heard Evans's exuberant voice, "Hot diggity dog!" There was nothing complicated about Ron Evans. He'd worked just as hard backing up Roosa for Apollo 14 as he had for his own flight. Now he was in his element. "Talk about being a spaceman, this is it!" On the screen, Roosa could see him waving. "Hello, Mom. Hello, Jan. Hi, John. How you doing? Hi, Jamie." There wasn't anyone in that control room who truly understood how Roosa felt watching this. He had trained to make that spacewalk himself dozens of times. With the lack of flights, Deke Slayton started putting experienced astronauts on the backup crews to save the extra time, money, and effort that would have been required to train rookies. When Roosa and Ed Mitchell came off Apollo 14, they were assigned to backup 16 with Fred Hayes as the commander. Before Apollo 14, Mitchell had seen the assignment coming and had balked, but Slayton made it clear that he'd better go along or he wouldn't fly. But there was no resistance from Roosa. He'd wanted the assignment. There was always the chance that something would happen and he'd get to go, though he would have had some very mixed feelings about flying if it meant Ken Mattingly were grounded again. Still, on the day Apollo 16 was launched, he was standing with Fred Hayes, and Hayes was talking about how hard it was to train for more than a year and get all cranked up to fly and then just stand there and watch somebody else go instead. If Roosa said anything in response, it wasn't necessary. Anyone who'd ever done time on a backup crew knew what he was talking about. It was right around that time that the Stamp affair broke, and in the shake-up that followed, Scott, Worden, and Irwin were taken off the Apollo 17 backup crew, and in their place, Slayton assigned Roosa along with John Young and Charlie Duke, just back from their world tour. And Stu Roosa, veteran astronaut, found himself serving on two backup crews in a row. The three of them joked about being the only all-Southern crew. They grew mustaches just for the hell of it, and they trained for a mission they knew they would probably never fly. By the time launch day rolled around, Roosa figured he had more time in the command module simulator than any other astronaut. He was ready to go back to the moon, more than ready. His best friend, Charlie Duke, felt the same way, but he knew nothing was going to keep Jack Schmidt from getting to the moon short of a broken leg, and even then, Duke figured, NASA would probably postpone the mission. Roosa had been more hopeful. He wanted a chance to do it again and do it even better, if that was humanly possible. He'd take more photographs, he'd make more observations, and this time he wouldn't let so much of the experience get away from him. He'd be more relaxed, he'd have time to collect his thoughts, he'd enjoy it a little more, and he wanted to make that spacewalk 180,000 miles from Earth. But that experience, like a second trip to the moon, was now forever beyond his reach. "Okay, put the old sun visor down now. I see what Charlie Duke meant. Man, it's dark out here. Whoops, come back here, little cassette. Okay, I'm coming back in." A few days later, when Apollo 17 splashed down, the control room was so packed with people that it was hard to walk around. It seemed every flight director and flight controller who'd ever worked on Apollo had been drawn to this room to see the last mission end. And Rusa was there, seated next to the Capcom, along with Deke Slayton. He watched quietly as the command module descended under three perfect parachutes, while around him the room broke into applause. By the time Cernan, Evans, and Schmidt were being hoisted up to the helicopter, cigars were lit. Everyone was clapping and shaking hands. Minutes later, the big screen showed Cernan and his crew on the carrier deck making speeches. There were probably as many emotions in that room as there were people. Chris Kraft would say later that he was absolutely relieved when he saw the parachutes. They were getting out of this risky business at just the right time and with a great finish. One of the flight controllers would liken his own wistful sense of accomplishment to the feeling the architects of the pyramids must have had when the last one was finished. By nightfall, there were splashdown parties in full swing all around the Space Center communities, but there wasn't the same all-out feeling of celebration they'd had in 1969. In 1973, Rusa was assigned to the Space Shuttle program, and for the next few years he went to meetings and saw the program fall further and further behind. By 1976, it was clear that the first flight would probably slip well beyond its 1978 target date, and Rusa knew he wasn't first in line. By the time he had a chance to fly again, it might be more than a decade after Apollo 14. He'd be a spacecraft commander, but he'd also be 47 years old. But if he was going to leave what Ron Evans called the best job in the world, what would he do? He thought about going back to the Air Force, but he was told there was a lot of anti-astronaut sentiment there because the stamp affair had been done by an all-Air Force crew. So Rusa decided to leave NASA and try his hand at business. He had been contacted by a corporation that wanted to expand its operations in the Middle East. They had offered him a vice president's position in Athens. It sounded challenging, and the kids would enjoy the change, but Rusa never really felt that he'd found something to replace what he did from 1966 to 1972. Someone had called it mankind's greatest adventure. What could Rusa add to that? On the day he decided to leave, he called George Lowe, and they talked about his plans. Rusa said he was really going to miss NASA, but that it was time to move on. Then Lowe was quiet for a moment, and he said, "You know, there will never be another Apollo in anybody's life." Epilogue. The Audiences of the Moon. In 1975, during a trip to Nepal with his wife, Joan, Stu Rusa visited a school to give a talk about his flight to the moon. Afterward, there were mysterious questions. "Who did you see?" Rusa answered, "There is no one there." A murmur went through the place. Again the students asked what he had seen. Rusa was adamant. "There is nothing there, not even wind. There is nothing." Later, after the Rusas had gone, a teacher told the children, "You mustn't listen to him. He's wrong." The Rusas were distressed when they learned that some Nepalese believe the spirits of their ancestors reside on the moon. Rusa had essentially told them there was no heaven. Joan wished the American government had briefed them better for the trip. One day at the hotel, Joan went to get her hair done. The woman giving her a shampoo said, "You're married to the astronaut, aren't you?" "Yes, I am." "You know, you're married to a god." Joan laughed it off, but when she and Stuart went to that evening's gathering, all along the mountain road children were kneeling with candles in an act of reverence. A god had come to visit. In the mid-1970s, a series of television advertisements for the American Express card featured notables whose faces were unknown to the public. Two of them were William Miller, who ran for vice president in 1964, and Mel Blanc, who did the voice of Bugs Bunny. And in one of the great ironies of our age, the producers chose a man who had been to the moon. On TVs across America, there was Pete Conrad, grinning his gap-toothed grin, saying, "Do you know me? I walked on the moon." For Conrad, the ad changed things for a little while. "Up until the time I did that," says Conrad, "I could go anywhere and nobody knew me. All right, I did that American Express commercial, and while that sumbitch was running, I couldn't take a leak. I remember trying to take a leak in Philadelphia, and a guy standing there says," Conrad lurches into a crazed persona, "I know you." Then the ad stopped running, and Conrad's sudden fame evaporated as quickly as it had come. Today, the moon voyagers are scattered across the country, and most of them are as anonymous as Pete Conrad. Many, like him, are corporate executives, and most agree with the credo Conrad stated one day, sitting in his office at McDonnell Douglas in Long Beach, California. "Don't ever look back. I'm serious. What's the point of looking back? I've already been there. How about some old guy sitting around telling you about how he played football for good old Yale University and was the world's greatest quarterback? That's all the bastard ever talks about, okay?" To Conrad, the scene he has just described is so awful that no further explanation is necessary. From time to time, however, usually for the benefit of an interviewer, Conrad does look back, and even among astronauts he is known as a great spinner of space yarns, or lies and sea stories, as he calls them. But Conrad has kept the promise he made to himself on the day he was selected as an astronaut in 1962. Going to the moon, he says, hasn't changed him. "But that isn't what people want to hear," says Conrad. "They've got some preconceived notion that I should tell them I was frightened, or I was awe-inspired, or I saw the Lord, or I don't know." The truth sounds unbelievable. When he was on the moon, his strongest feeling was that it was the right place to be at the time. That just shuts the door. So does the thought of a man who has been to the moon and who today does not look at it. "They know I'm lying," they say. "Don't you go out and look at the moon?" And I honestly don't. When Pete Conrad looks back on his spaceflight career, the high point isn't his lunar landing. It is the rescue of the Skylab space station in 1973. The station's outer shield, which protected it against heat and micrometeorites, was torn off during launch, taking one of its power-producing solar panels with it. Getting power to Skylab depended on freeing the remaining wing, which was lashed down by debris. Conrad's crew, who had been preparing for a month-long mission aboard Skylab, was now faced with carrying out a demanding repair. Arriving at the stricken station, they sweltered in desert-like heat for days until they could erect a makeshift sunshield. 2 weeks into the flight, Conrad and his crewmate Joe Kerwin made a spacewalk and, with some difficulty, freed the stuck solar wing. Today, Conrad looks back with a healthy appreciation of the risks he took. "My life was a lot further out on the line, on Skylab, than it was on the moon," Conrad says. "That taxed me personally, put everything that I had spent my whole life learning how to do on the line. Going to the moon was basically a nice routine flight after the lightning. We didn't have any trouble after that. On Skylab, we didn't know whether we would leave or stay for 14 days. In 1978, Congress recognized the success by awarding Conrad the newly created Space Medal of Honor. "Everybody thinks I got the Space Medal of Honor because I went to the moon. I say, no, it was for Skylab." They say, "Oh, Skylab, yes, what was Skylab?" It's the moon that people want to hear about, and like all his colleagues, when Conrad is introduced as one of the 24 men who went there, the question he is almost always asked is, "What was it like?" And he gives the neat 2-second answer he developed long ago. "Super, really enjoyed it." "Space changes nobody," Stu Roosa said flatly in 1990. To be sure, Roosa talked about the impact of seeing the Earth from deep space and the lunar landscape. You can't see those things and not be affected, but it didn't change him. "You bring back from space what you bring into space," he said. Roosa's words are ironic, considering the fact that one of the two men who rode with him on Apollo 14 says his own perspective, his life, Even his very sense of being were profoundly altered by the voyage. He is Ed Mitchell. Since 1971, Mitchell has tried to understand what happened to him inside the command module Kitty Hawk heading toward Earth when he saw the universe revealed in a flash of understanding. Now a freelance management consultant in Boca Raton, Florida, Mitchell talks with quiet intensity about his consciousness-changing experience in space and the journey that followed. When Mitchell came back from Apollo 14, the other astronauts heard about his attempt to transmit his thoughts through space. Some, he says, even came by his office to talk about it, when no one was watching, but none of them knew that Mitchell had returned to Earth a changed man. Even he did not really comprehend his experience. "I didn't know what feelings were," Mitchell says of himself as a returned moon voyager. "People used to ask, what did it feel like to be on the moon? I didn't know what it felt like. I could tell them what I did and what I thought, but not how I felt. It pissed me off." But Mitchell realized that answering the question was a key to unraveling his revelation in space. He sought out two researchers in consciousness, Jean Houston and her husband Bob Masters, and through them relived the experience via hypnosis. From there, Mitchell began to gain understanding. He spent the next 15 years piecing together a new truth. In 1973, he founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Palo Alto, California, devoted to the scientific study of consciousness. Even after leaving daily operations at the Institute in 1982, Mitchell continued his quest for scientific explanations of consciousness. He helped arrange experiments to test the claims of psychic Uri Geller, whose spoon-bending and other feats of telekinesis made him a talk show celebrity. He has also delved into the work of such avant-garde scientists as physicist David Bohm, who proposed a kind of consciousness at the level of subatomic particles. Like Bohm, Mitchell believes that consciousness is an attribute of everything in existence, animate and inanimate. Today, Mitchell believes that telepathy, clairvoyance, intuition, and other psychic phenomena have a single explanation. It's just information. Information, Mitchell says, is the other half of the universe, the intangible complement to matter. An information field pervades space, like a cosmic data bank, that records, among other things, the accumulated experiences of all matter, including living organisms throughout history. Mitchell believes that a person who is sensitive to this information, which exists, he says, as a form of energy, can experience anything from clairvoyance to telekinesis. When he had a shift in consciousness on the way home from the moon, he says, he was tuning into the data bank. Why didn't the other astronauts experience the same thing? They did, according to Mitchell, whether or not they express it. The informational input is the same, but what is actually received is shaped by our level of awareness and by the filter we call belief system. Mitchell believes he has found the resolution between science and spirituality that he hungered for as a teenager. "To me, divinity is the intelligence existing in the universe. That universe," he adds, "is a learning, growing, changing organism, like the human beings who strive to understand it and who have only begun to explore it." It is my joy to be with you tonight to share the love of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, Jim Irwin said in 1988, standing before a packed meeting hall in Colorado Springs. After a series of major heart attacks, he appeared thin and almost frail compared to his astronaut days, but his eyes were bright and penetrating, revealing an unmistakable inner strength and determination. "I come to you as a former astronaut," Irwin continued. A wry smile crossed his face. "I feel like the ancient astronaut, the shrinking astronaut, but I'm glad that I'm still alive and that I can be here." This is how Jim Irwin spent the last two decades of his life, sharing his faith, testifying to the love of God that he discovered, he said, on the moon. Irwin embraced the task of recounting his experiences again and again, reciting stories he had long ago committed to memory. He talked about the white rock he spotted at Spur Crater, presented on its own pedestal as if on an outstretched hand. Holding up a plastic model of the rock, There was almost nothing left of the real one, he would say, which had been cut up and sent to scientists around the world. He talked of the real impact of his trip to the moon, his realization that God is alive and available everywhere in the universe. Back on Earth, that awakening caused Irwin's life to change dramatically. Urged by his wife to heed this new spiritual call, supported by family friend and minister Bill Rittenhouse, Irwin left the astronaut corps and founded the High Flight Ministry in 1972. The timing was significant. The stamp affair had just become news. By publicly admitting that he had made a mistake, Irwin took himself off the pedestal reserved for conquerors of the heavens. At the same time, he began a life that could not be more different from the one he led as a test pilot. The quiet, introverted engineer now faced a life of public speaking, something he said he dreaded but grew to enjoy. 1 month he was in India, visiting polio-stricken children. Another he was witnessing in Eastern Europe. He gave his testimony in churches across the United States. Someone nicknamed him the Moon Missionary. It was hard for some of Irwin's astronaut colleagues to understand his transformation. They would joke, "I don't know what happened to old Jim up there." Irwin had expected that response, but for his own part, he had no doubts about why his life took the path it did. God had a plan for me to leave the Earth and to share the adventure with others so that they can be lifted up. Going to the moon, he said, prepared me for a role of greater service. To attend one of Irwin's appearances was to get a sense of how many lives he touched. In 1989, after sharing his faith on the campus of a small Baptist college near Worcester, Massachusetts, Irwin was mobbed by admirers and signed autographs for nearly an hour. That night, the organizer of a dinner given in Irwin's honor by the local Hispanic community spoke of her dream to bring Irwin to Puerto Rico so that the children there could hear how he reached for the stars and know that they could do the same. Irwin managed to find an element of exploration in his new life. Beginning in 1973, he participated in several expeditions to Turkey's Mount Ararat to search for the remains of Noah's Ark. In 1982, Irwin took a bad fall on Ararat's rocky slopes, almost losing his life. In the summer of 1986, near his Colorado Springs home, Irwin suffered a near-fatal cardiac arrest. Only weeks later, he was recovering at home, pedaling an exercise bike and talking about going back to Turkey to continue his quest. "I realize that my time is running out," he said calmly, looking off toward the mountains. "I want to take care of myself as best I can so I can stick around and be of help. I just hope that when the Lord's finished with me that I go quickly." In the years that followed, Irwin continued a grueling schedule of appearances, cutting down to two a day after his doctor warned him to slow down. In August 1991, Irwin died following a heart attack while in the Colorado mountains he loved. If you talk to the moon voyagers, you will find that most of them think about the experience the way Bill Anders does. He doesn't describe the kind of life-changing impact that came to Jim Irwin and Ed Mitchell. He does say that the experience of being one of the first three men to circle the moon, and in particular seeing the Earth rise, broadened his perspective forever. It also made him something of an oracle for a time. On the banquet circuit after Apollo 8, people would ask him and his crewmates about the chances for world peace and how the stock market was going to behave. "Pretty soon," Anders laughs, "it's easier to answer than to explain we don't know anything about it." That wasn't the only thing Anders didn't know about when he left NASA. Like his colleagues, he was highly trained for the business of spaceflight and untrained for real dollars and cents business. But he was clear about one thing. He didn't want to build a new career on his status as a moon voyager. It did open doors, however. In 1969, the Nixon White House appointed him as executive secretary of its National Aeronautics and Space Council. He went on to head the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, making use of his pre-NASA experience as a nuclear engineer. His performance in that job won him a stint as ambassador to Norway. In 1977, after 8 years of government jobs in which he learned, among other things, how to keep out of the way of Machiavelli's knife, Anders was recruited for an executive vice president's post at General Electric, which he called his business boot camp experience. In 1984, he was hired by Textron to run their aerospace and commercial divisions. Within a few years, Anders was Textron's chief operating officer, earning more than $1 million a year. One day in 1987, Anders reflected on the challenges he and his colleagues faced in making second careers. You're given unrealistic opportunities that you wouldn't have had otherwise, and measured by an unrealistic yardstick. The title of ex-astronaut may open some doors, Anders says, but once inside, you really have to perform. For Mike Collins, that meant a year as the Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, a job that taught him, in his words, how to operate in the strange, semi-hysterical environment of official Washington. Thus prepared, he became the first director of the Smithsonian's new National Air and Space Museum, overseeing its design and construction. It opened ahead of schedule, a few days before the bicentennial in 1976, and within budget, an almost unheard-of set of circumstances. Collins's hope that it would be the most exciting museum in the world was borne out by attendance figures. In 3 weeks, it drew 1 million visitors. By the end of the year, that figure had risen to 10 million. For Jack Schmidt, who refuses to see his moon flight as the high point of his career, the whole thing was a continuum for me, he says, a steadily rising level of experience and no drop-off at the end. Recognition as a former astronaut helped him run for a Senate seat in 1976 against senior Democrat Joseph Montoya. All the astronaut thing did was balance that ledger. He had seniority, I had astronaut. I could get as many speaking engagements as he could, but it didn't win the election. What won the election was the Democrats were mad at Montoya. Schmidt hoped he might bring a different intellectual base to the discussion of issues in the Senate, but his term was a frustrating and disillusioning experience. He felt like more of an outsider in the Senate than he had in the astronaut corps, he explains, because I was a Republican, scientist, technologist, interested in issues of the future in addition to those of the present, and there wasn't anybody else there interested. There still isn't. The Congress of the United States is not fertile ground for working those kinds of problems. Schmidt lost a re-election bid in 1982. Meanwhile, for Bill Anders, success came at a price. He was on the road constantly. His only moments of relaxation were found aboard his sailboat, Apogee. Money isn't everything, Anders said in 1989. Sailing is everything. That year, when Anders was seriously thinking of retiring, he was recruited to head General Dynamics, one of the largest defense contractors in the country. By 1992, however, the Cold War was over, and Anders was in charge of guiding General Dynamics through the turbulent transition. After a controversial recovery effort that involved massive layoffs and a lucrative incentive program for the company managers, General Dynamics made a dramatic turnaround. GD's stock price more than quadrupled, and the company returned more than $2 billion to lenders and shareholders, a move that Anders says shocked competitors but won praise in the Pentagon and on Wall Street. Anders's own earnings for 1992 put him in Fortune magazine's list of the top 10 highest-paid CEOs. In 1993, he stepped down as CEO in what appeared to be retirement, moving to an island off the coast of Washington State. In reality, he is still serving as General Dynamics chairman of the board, still traveling, still wishing he had more time for boating. Sometimes, out on the water, he catches sight of the moon, and aside from a memory of feeling of disbelief, he wonders if the whole thing was a very realistic simulation. He is wryly aware that he doesn't see it the way most others do. Other people will say, "Oh, what a beautiful moon." I'll think to myself, "If they could just see it up close. It appears beautiful because it's a long ways off and you can't see it's really a very uninviting place." Anders concedes that he would probably feel differently if he'd been able to see the moon the way his 12 moonwalking colleagues had. It is still one of Anders's regrets. For all his satisfaction at having flown Apollo 8, he would rather have been the last man to walk on the moon than the first to go around it. For many years, Bill Anders noted the progress of the other astronauts as they tackled life after the moon, but he paid special attention to Frank Borman. Borman had left NASA with international fame, but had been determined not to coast on his celebrity. His plate was full with lucrative offers to join anything from aerospace giants to broadcasting companies. A few wanted him for PR purposes, to be the company astronaut, and that was something he wanted to avoid. In the end, he went to work for Eastern Airlines. The airline business, he felt, was something he could sink his teeth into. After 7 years as a senior vice president, Borman was named Eastern's top executive in 1976. His gruff management style, along with his aversion to the lush corporate lifestyle of his predecessors, ruffled more than a few feathers among his executives. But soon, after a long decline in the 1960s, Eastern was enjoying the most profitable years in its history. Then, in 1978, deregulation hit the airline industry and Borman's troubles began to build. Beset by high labor costs and low employee morale, he found himself in a bitter power struggle with leaders of Eastern's unions that dragged on into the 1980s. The last traumatic confrontation came in early 1986 when Eastern's board accepted Frank Lorenzo's offer to buy the airline. In Borman's own words, it was his first failed mission, says Anders. I think he had a business problem that nobody could solve. Meanwhile, Anders had been wishing for some kind of Apollo 8 fraternity and for a reunion with his former commander. For several years, he'd marked the anniversary of the flight by sending his crewmates a telegram, "Let's get together." After a while, Anders says, I realized I wasn't even hearing back from Borman. I finally gave up. Anders couldn't have been more surprised when, one day in the summer of 1986, his secretary said, Frank Borman is on the line. When Anders picked up the phone, Bill? Frank. Borman sounded as if he'd talked to him the day before. The call turned out to be for advice on an airplane engine Borman was buying, but about a year later Borman called again just to say hello. If you ever come out here, he told Anders, love to see you. That phone call was the first time that Frank Borman and I have communicated when he's not under pressure, Anders said a few weeks later. He speculated that Borman, who had moved to Las Cruces, New Mexico, where his son ran a car dealership, had gotten over the sting of his defeat at Eastern, said Anders. He's probably mellowed. In 1988, the Apollo 8 fraternity finally convened at the Aerospace Hall of Fame in San Diego in time for the flight's 20th anniversary. Seeing his crewmates together for the first time in 16 years, Anders had a chance to renew the friendships and settle an old score. For years, Frank Borman had maintained that he had taken the famous picture of the first Earthrise. He even said he'd had to grab the camera away from Anders to do it. A few years later, just for fun, Jim Lovell threw his hat in the ring, insisting he took the picture. To settle the issue, Anders had a NASA photography expert research the matter, and the results seemed to be in Anders's favor, but that didn't stop Borman from sticking by his story. Fortunately for Anders, Apollo 8's onboard voice recorder issued the final, unequivocal verdict. Anders took the picture. In San Diego, during a slide presentation before a group of high school students, up came the Earthrise photo. I'd better not comment on this one, Anders said. Jim, why don't you comment? Lovell announced, This picture has always been under contention. I think it's time now for Frank to have a public admission. Throughout the event, the Earthrise picture became a running joke, and Borman took it all with good humor. Anders's suspicions about Borman were correct. He had indeed mellowed. I'm one of the few guys you may meet that's at peace with himself, Borman says. First of all, I'm lucky to be alive. I made it through some very traumatic times. I've got the same healthy, supportive wife I started out with, a real accomplishment in the NASA group, and I've got two boys that we have good relationships with. And Las Cruces, he says, is a place where no one cares that he was president of Eastern or that he went to the moon. At the reunion one evening, Borman entered a restaurant with his wife and some friends, and the maitre d' stared at him for a long moment. Finally, he said, Didn't you used to be? I used to be with an airline, Borman said. The young man didn't get the hint. Borman offered him another clue. I used to be with NASA. Still no recognition. One of Borman's friends decided to end the suspense. He used to be an astronaut. At last, the maitre d' realized he was meeting a man who had been to the moon. But before he could say anything, Borman had the last word. But now I'm just an old fart. Years ago, Alan Shepard is said to have quipped, Before I went to the moon, I was a rotten SOB. Now I'm just an SOB. To those who know him, that statement alone, the fact that Shepard admitted any change at all, speaks volumes. I suppose I'm a little nicer now than I used to be, Shepard says. That, he adds, has everything to do with getting to prove himself on Apollo 14. Maybe it's because I wanted it so much, it was so important to me, and I did it, and I was able to relax and be a little more human. It is Alan Shepard, ego still very much intact, who shows a surprising degree of balance when it comes to looking back. Of his space experience, he says, you put it in a box, put it on the shelf, put a ribbon around it, and move on to something else. But he does not avoid opening the box, for example, when the moon is up. I never look at the moon anymore without thinking about it, just saying, wow. Only that. Then going on and doing whatever you were doing. In person, he seems younger than his 70 years. Tall, tanned, and fit, dressed casually but tastefully, he wears a gold chain around his neck bearing an Apollo 14 emblem. His brown hair, swept across his forehead, shows little gray. Alan Shepard is aging gracefully, and part of his maturing, he says, is the understanding that there are things in life other than flying airplanes. Today, Shepard still serves as chairman of a consulting business called 714 Enterprises. He's on the board of directors of 12 or 15 companies, including Kmart and Quick Copy, and he is president of the Mercury 7 Foundation, created by the original Seven to give scholarships to college students studying space and engineering. None of the moon voyagers, save Neil Armstrong, has as much name recognition, and Shepard is able to use his fame to raise money for the foundation. Though he is more often identified as the first American in space, he is also the first lunar golfer and participates in lucrative celebrity tournaments, and it is for the foundation that Shepard is happy to look back. I don't mind going back and opening up the box again from time to time, Shepard says of his speaking engagements, and I find it satisfying for me to do it and make some money for this foundation. To be able to share that experience with someone is fun, and at the same time create monies for youngsters in college that want to get involved in scientific pursuits, I find that very satisfying. A splendid moon, ripening toward full, graces the October dusk. As darkness settles on the town of Acton, Massachusetts, there is activity at the high school and an air of expectancy. Cars stream into the parking lot. Parents and children file into the large auditorium. This night they will hear the experiences of a man who walked on the moon. Even now, well before the presentation begins, he is seated in the front row, greeting some of his audience, signing autographs. Tall, white-haired, dark-suited, Gene Cernan has the larger-than-life look of a celebrity. That is something that has been reinforced by television. If you were watching in the weeks after the Challenger disaster, you probably saw him on World News Tonight, or conversing with Ted Koppel from a giant Nightline screen. For more than 20 years, Cernan has been making public appearances, and he still looks the way people expect an astronaut to look. Cernan's audience this evening spans two generations. Many of the parents were in college when Cernan walked on the moon. Most of them would not, if asked, have been able to identify him as the last to leave his footprints in the lunar dust. Nor would many of their children, who have grown up in an age in which space travel seems routine. For them, Apollo is a story in their history books. Tonight, Cernan will talk to the parents about the importance of education, about the need for America to find a goal in space to mobilize its technology and capture the imagination of its people. But first he looks back. I can take you to the surface of the moon so that you're standing next to me, Cernan likes to say, and standing on the stage, he launches into a symphony of recollection. He tells of looking at the beauty of the sunlit earth, surrounded by the blackest black you can conceive of. I can't show it to you, but I can tell you it exists, because I saw it with my own eyes. And the audience is transported by the words of a space traveler.